You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 126 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. I said that as if it was a question there.
Things have gotten bad. It has become a question.
Things have gotten bad. They still won the Super Bowl.
Every week we go through and it's like episode 120. You have to add the one now at this point. But like episode 25 last week would have been the Sherman edition. Episode 26 this week. We're going through the Legion of Boom. Or what was the Legion of Boom?
Wait, are you counting Shaquille Griffin?
Yeah. You know, the thing Shaquille
Griffin... Yeah, no, he counts as the Legion of Boom. But yeah. He wasn't what was the Legion of Boom, since he's the one who's still here. I was thinking of Ken Hamlin. That was the first thought that came to mind.
The original Legion 26. Of Boom. Stretching all the way from the original Legion of Boom to the current Legion of Boom.
This week, so we should probably get right into our beer.
Oh, wow.
We have here, from Silver City Brewing in Silverdale, Washington, the Oktoberfest Lager.
That poured so nicely.
It did. I would like to start with a toast to Sue Bird, Jewel Lloyd, Brianna Stewart, and assistant coach Dan Hughes, who followed up the WNBA championship they won last month by going over to Spain and helping lead the U.S. women's national team to their third consecutive victory in the FIBA World Cup for women. This is Bird's fourth win in a record of 5 appearances in the World Cup, first for the others. And Brianna Stewart was named MVP of the tournament to go along with MVP of the WNBA regular season and the WNBA finals. The only MVP she didn't win this year was the All-Star game.
Wow. That's Brianna Stewart amazing. Might be good.
Yeah.
Quickly, on the Silver City Oktoberfest Lager. Celebrate the season with tradition and authenticity. The classic amber lager presents rich malty sweetness and spicy hop character. And I want to say, shout to third Talkin' Taco Timer, Chris, who's going to be at Oktoberfest this weekend in Munich, Germany.
Oh, that's great.
Along with third Pelton brother, Never, loyal listener, David Sykes, who's going to be there also.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, how about that?
And I also...
So prolific.
I wanted to say, this is the
Did David Sykes ever participate in one of the tournaments that we had? The burger bracket? I think he might have.
Oh, yeah, he was. He's a third Pelton brother.
Yeah.
He came on and reviewed some burger. I can't remember which one. I also want to say in the announcements portion of the podcast, because that's what this is, that if there's anybody, if there are any crossover Peltoncast back-to-back listeners, and you'll be in New York City on Friday for the sold-out back-to-back live, much more successful than the Peltoncast live, definitely come and say hi to me, because I will be there. Do not say hi to you, because you won't be there.
That is accurate.
Anyway, if you're there, come and say hi. I'll be there for most of the night hanging out. And if you don't recognize me, ask somebody who knows. Ask Jade.
I will be extremely bummed not to be there, but it is for a very good reason. The fact that this Friday night, we'll talk more about it later in the pod, but the very last event ever at Key Arena before renovation begins this fall, NBA preseason, NBA returning for one night only with the Kings Warriors preseason game. And leading up to that,
yes,
I put together a special Peltoncast podcast, a one-off telling the history of Key Arena with special guests, including Sue Bird, George Carl, Nate McMillan, many more. It was a lot of fun to do. Hopefully a lot of fun for people to listen to. If you haven't already, please check that out. Although, in this case, I will not recommend that you stop everything and listen to it immediately, because it is not as time sensitive as this podcast is.
Key Arena is going away either way.
It's true. You've got years before it comes back.
It was a unique Peltoncast in as much as it was good.
Well, I thought you were going to say that you weren't on it, but maybe that's redundant.
That's what made it good.
Yeah. You were referenced one time when I talked about us sharing season tickets.
Oh, there we go. That's all I ask for. I just asked for a name drop on the podcast I'm not on.
Should we just get into this here? Do we want to talk about memories of Key Arena?
Memories of Key Arena?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Do you have any memories of Key Arena?
I don't remember at all. I'm trying to think. I mean,
you went to the first game at Key Arena. I was not there. You were there.
The
Do you
first
remember
ever
that
game
one?
At Key Arena. They played the Lakers, maybe. Is that right?
I believe that is accurate.
And so I remember this pretty shockingly well. I think at the time, McDonald's was running a promotion where you could get like 6 nuggets for a dollar. Now they do, I think, 4 nuggets for a dollar.
Okay, this checks out.
And I think I walked in, and in the inside pocket of my jacket, I had 6 nuggets that me and our dad had bought on the way to the game.
I like that this is your Key Arena memory.
So there's that. This is the first ever game.
Okay.
I mean, there are tons of... We had some good times at Key Arena.
We sure did. I mean, being up in Section 222, the home of the real fans back in the day.
And then 208, home of the real fan.
We started in 222 and went to 208,
yes.
Right? Yeah. 222 still feels more like home. Although if I went up there...
We were in row 12.
Like, well, one row from the very top when we started. there was the last row, and then there was us. And
in the end zone.
Made friends with Joe sitting next to us. That was, like, we had some great times hanging out with him at Sonics games.
Well, you know, the reason, and I think this was always kind of interesting, we'd been to tons of games in the old Coliseum or whatever, a lot of like standing room only,
right?
And then not that many when they were in the Tacoma Dome. I think I went to one, maybe two games in the Tacoma Dome.
I'm in the same boat.
There was one where we won tickets and then Vernon Maxwell called me shorty. Do you remember that? Were you at that game?
I don't think I was. That to me is like the lost season of Sonics basketball because I remember it so poorly.
You know what?
Because
there actually are a lot of lost seasons of Sonics basketball.
Well.
You're scoring at home.
The last season of Sonics basketball that actually happened because of the fact that like not only were did we go to a few of those games, at that point home games were only on TV on pay-per-view.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of listening to games on the radio that season.
I mean, honestly, through the 90s, like, you couldn't imagine a better arena to be at. I mean, I still, to this day, you mock me for liking the Kingdome, but the size of Key Arena could not have been more fitting for going to games in the second row in the end zone.
Right.
And then also just for that team, because it was so hot and exciting being inside Key Arena. Like, it doesn't feel cavernous at all.
I mean, I hope I captured that duality in the podcast that on the one hand, you know, the size was like it made it such an intimate experience and it was great once you were in the bowl. On the other hand, literally anytime you tried to do anything outside the bowl, it was terrible.
Anytime you tried to do anything outside the bowl, it was terrible?
Yeah, I mean, like it drives me crazy walking around the concourses now, how crowded they are.
It wasn't. It's not great. That didn't necessarily bother me as much, and it was so much about the fan
experience.
Because
you didn't know.
I didn't know, but also, it's just like being in those seats is incredible.
I mean, really, the main thing that ruined Key Arena for me is like going down to Portland on a regular basis.
Portland sucks as a fan,
yeah,
though.
Because if you're standing in the top row like you were the last time you went to a Blazers game,
you could be in the last row of Key Arena, any part of the building, and see the game well, and you feel like you're a part of it when you're up there. You don't even feel like you're a part of the game in Portland when you're at the top.
That's very reasonable. I definitely think it's better to be in the last row at Key Arena than it is in Portland. Fortunately, at this point in my life, because I'm a writer, I am not in the last row, and it is way
la-dee-da.
Better to be in Portland.
Okay, so some other memories of Key Arena. I mean, the first year that we were there, 95, 96, we couldn't have gotten season tickets at a better time.
No, it was the perfect time.
So I think our mom had determined, and the seats were $8 or $10.
I think $8 at that point.
$8 for these season tickets.
Well, at least $10 in the podcast, which I think it was. It definitely was by the end, but I think at the start, $8.
They were $10, like, maybe eventually they got up to more by the very bitter end, but I don't
think so.
I mean, it was not a big expense to go to 41 basketball games.
Really?
I mean, it's cheaper. We have season tickets. I have season tickets to the Seahawks, and we both have them for the Huskies. It's basically the same price as going to the 6 games for the Huskies and the 10 games for the Seahawks as going to 41 basketball games.
It's one thing that always drives me crazy is when people talk about how expensive like NBA tickets are.
You're not getting an $8 ticket anymore.
No, but you're getting a $10 ticket. There are a mandated number of $10 tickets in NBA arenas.
At every arena?
Yeah.
It's the standing room only seats behind the actual seats.
It's bizarre to me because it's the only place where people define how expensive something is by the most expensive prices rather than the least expensive prices, which makes no sense to me logically.
Okay. So I think that they were sold out, right? And we were on some kind of waiting list. And the ticket rep, Pete Weinmiller, I think. Am I right about this?
Pete Weinmiller would not have been a ticket rep.
I thought it was a notable person who the ticket rep was.
There was a woman named Sharon Wortman who worked for the Sonics for many years who I worked with.
I don't
who
think
sold
it would...
a, she was the one who actually was like the person who sold us the tickets as far as I know.
Really? In 95, 96?
Yeah.
So I remember our mom gets a call like the week before the season starts, right?
Is that right?
It's like
I don't remember
right
this at
before
all.
The season starts. And they're like, we have these two seats in 222 row 12. I think seats 12 and 13.
That sounds right. I should go up there on Friday. I should go sit in the old seats, actually. That would be
you know,
a cool
somebody
thing
will
do.
Have bought those tickets.
I mean, before the game. You'd be there very early.
You should try to get Kevin Durant to sit next to you there. but at home with a real fan. He seems like he's a real fan of Seattle.
Very positive about it.
Anyway, I think it was close to the season that it happened. And I remember us being pretty giddy. And the other memory, this is not really necessarily a Key Arena memory, but going through the games every year for the first 5 or 6 years that we shared tickets.
And drafting them out.
Drafting the games
oh, yeah,
before
that
the
counts.
Year. So much fun.
It was a lot of fun.
And then so that first year, the Sonics lost, I think, 2 games at home.
It was actually 3. I thought it was 2, but I looked it up. It was 38-3.
During the regular season.
And I wasn't at any of them during the regular season.
And
you were at all
the
losses.
All
and
of them for the playoffs.
Then yes, every single... the both games I went to in the playoffs, we lost. Game 5 against the Jazz and Game 3 against the Bulls. And then I gave up. I was scheduled to go to Game 5 against the Bulls. I let you go instead
you
because I thought
it
was bad luck.
You won Game 5 for the Sonics.
Yeah. that's another... that actually probably would have been a good story to tell on the podcast.
But I remember leaving from our family Thanksgiving, right? It was a Sunday night. In 1995, the Pelton family Thanksgiving party, not on Thanksgiving Day, going to Sonics versus Bulls.
Which is not traditionally on a Sunday Thanksgiving, yes.
This is it's a secondary family Thanksgiving.
It's Pelton guest calendar.
Going to Sonics versus Bulls, Gary Payton with a steal from Michael Jordan to win that game. And it's like, this is what having season tickets is all about.
I mean, to me, what having season tickets is all about... Steve Kelly sort of talked about this in the podcast, is like the fact that just any random given night, like the February game against the Jazz where Ray Allen scored 54 points in overtime during, I think, a snowstorm in that game. I feel like there was a snowstorm at that one. But just that to me is the best thing about the NBA. It's just those random nights that turn out to be super memorable.
And honestly, like it's either a huge, like sometimes when the team is good and you have like a Friday night game against a good team, the energy in the building was so good and everybody was just like so excited and prepared for the game and cheering throughout. But then also you have like random weeknight games, and Key Arena is a good hanging out arena also.
Is it?
I think basketball is a subtly good hanging out sport. It's an underrated hanging out sport.
I mean, it's definitely no baseball in terms of the hang.
But baseball, you feel like you need to move. Basketball, you sit in your seats and you watch and you can carry on a conversation for a good chunk of time watching basketball. Football, you can't really do it.
No.
Like football, the conversation needs to be about football.
But you mostly needs to be complaining about me, if I understand correctly, about us going to games.
That has less... When I'm at the Seahawks games and not with you, we do less complaining about you. Some, just less. I would say more complaining about the Seahawks.
The fans, I was going to say the fans around you not cheering enough.
No, but it's more just like, oh, this thing happened. Like you're just talking.
Oh, well, we got plenty of time for that.
But it's more like pointing things out, yes. Considering things. In basketball, like... The game is happening and you're not doing that much analyzing of it. You're watching and you're cheering. It's like it can be a passive experience that you can also enjoy. And Key Arena was a great arena for that. So then that full season going through game 7, being at game 7 against the Jazz to go to the NBA finals and just staying there after, well, it's like, we don't know what to do. Right? You feel kind of like an ownership of your area. You get to know the people around you when you have season tickets. And like I remember during one of the games in the Rockets series, I think it was game 1 where we blew out the Rockets, right?
That is correct.
In the sweep in the second round against the Rockets. And we had sat in the seats behind us and they gave out rally towels and I was 10 or whatever and like hit the, some people came and sat in our seats. Me and Joseph sat in the row behind us because it was wide open and some people came and sat in our seats and I was like waving a rally towel and hit one of them and they got like mad, and Joseph being so intimidating and like, he was like, they'd like turned around and he said something about like them actually being in our seats and we could get them kicked out. And I was like, first off, prepared, like, this person is going to be a lawyer. Second off, like, these grown men were frightened of him as like probably a 15-year-old.
Yep.
So the first season obviously was great, but honestly, even beyond that, just like every year, my favorite season of any sports team ever, including the Seahawks, was the 05-06 Sonic season.
You mean
04-05 Sonic season.
You just really loved that Bob Weiss, Bob Hill team.
Yeah.
One of the worst defenses in NBA history.
The 04-05 Sonics team, because you hear people talking about like classic teams or whatever, and it was one of those situations where there were not a lot of people on the Sonics bandwagon at the beginning of that year.
I wasn't on the Sonics bandwagon at the beginning of that year.
But you're still invested, right? It's one of those things where it's like when you have season tickets to something, you're there from the very beginning and you can see it kind of grow through, oh, this is a surprising team, to, I'm not going to say that they like enraptured the town in the same way that some Seahawks teams have or some Mariners teams have.
No.
And I mean, maybe that's an unfortunate side effect of the Sonics being in Seattle, is that didn't really happen at any point after the 90s. But just being such a surprise team was like, we knew these players. Like, it was almost like you don't have a personal relationship with Danny Fortson or Rashard Lewis or Ray Allen, but you feel like you know them.
Yes.
You're about to say, you're giving the smirk that you have a personal relationship with
them. I would
say
I do with Danny Fortson.
But you're seeing them so often when you have season tickets. I mean, these are less Kirina memories and more just pro season ticket memories. But I feel like the arena itself. And so that year, you were working for the team and you had good seats.
Yes.
Good-ish seats that you wouldn't sit in. So we had four people.
I mean, I was on press row. But yeah.
Typically me, our mom, my girlfriend at the time, and our cousin Chris. And weirdly enough, my girlfriend at the time and our mom would sit together, which in hindsight is kind of a shocking thing. And me and Chris would sit together, which is kind of amazing that all parties involved let this happen. It was a different era. But
was it a different era?
Can you imagine Mrs. Fantasy Genius? I'm saying like that.
Yes.
The people involved, Mrs. Fantasy Genius, sitting with Jan for 41 basketball games.
That would be a lot.
Never happened. She wouldn't sit with Jan for one basketball game. She'd be like, I'm not going. Anyway, we would switch at halftime. So we would have the seats in the first half, me and Chris in the first half, and then they would have the seats in the second half, and we'd move up to the top for the second half, and it was equally as fun in each place.
That's interesting.
Huh. It was like, you got to see two different perspectives on the game, but you still felt engaged in the game. And I remember there was a Pistons game on a Friday night, and the Pistons were one of the best teams in the league, right? They went on to play in the championship that year.
Yeah, they were the defending champions and went back to the finals that year.
And the Sonics beat them on a Friday night, and it was like rowdy. There was a fight in the crowd. Do you remember this?
No.
This predated, obviously, the Pistons-Pacers fight that happened, which maybe we should have known.
No, it wouldn't have predated it. That was that season.
It was that season?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, the Pistons didn't have anyone suspended. They didn't go in there. I mean, they had some suspensions, but not for the whole season.
Oh, so maybe it was after. This wasn't a fight that involved players. There was a fight in the crowd at the game, though. Lil Jon was showing up that year.
He was.
To games?
One of my most infamous stories is in the live from the press box, like basically in-game blog I was doing at the time, I wasted my celebrity sighting.
Streets ahead, by the way.
It really was.
What you were doing.
I wasted my in-game celebrity sighting of the year on Mario Lopez early in the season before Lil Jon showed up.
I know. That's a tough one now in hindsight.
But the fact that Lil Jon was such a part of the zeitgeist at that point because of the Chappelle Show skit.
Yes.
And I rode in an elevator at the Sonics offices with Lil Jon because Cube was in the same building as KJR was too. But he was going up to Cube. So I rode up in the elevator with Lil Jon.
There you go. Did he have his gas can with him?
He didn't at that point, but he did at the game.
Sideline. Courtside at the game. Lil Jon with a gas can.
Which doesn't seem like it should be illegal, but you know, it's Lil Jon, so.
Okay, so some other Kyrie. I know I'm talking the entire time on these Kyrie memories. Everybody's heard your Kyrie memories. No, I'm curious to hear yours after. But the other one was, and I've talked about this before, but being able to, this was near the one of the last 2 years, right? Doing the 90s trivia. Was this, it was 90s, right? It wasn't 80s, where it was just like a Key Arena promotion where I should not have been involved.
Sonic's promotion.
Well, it was Sonic's promotion that was happening during halftime.
Yes.
And they had a panelist of people, and Squatch would hold up a photo of something from the 90s, and you would ring a buzzer and say what it was, right?
Yes.
And I think the only one that I missed was Beverly Hills 90210. But it's just like a photo of Salt and Peppa, and you're like, bam, Salt and Peppa. And I dominated.
It was designed well for you.
I crushed that. So doing that, and then the prize that I won for that was sitting in a Lazy Boy behind the seats. And somehow we managed to turn. I think it was supposed to be two, but we negotiated it into three. With me, the same girlfriend at the time, and Jan, of course. They had to sit together because they were accustomed to it at that point. Sitting behind the hoop in three Lazy Boys. And then unexpectedly being called, I sort of had a sense of this, but I didn't practice, unexpectedly being called onto the court to shoot a half-court shot, which had the distance but was off by like 3 feet.
More than 3 feet.
Oh, I wish that I wish we had a video of this.
I wish so too.
Having the distance is the most important part, because you know I'm good at shooting from far away.
You are. I will acknowledge that.
And then I airballed the half court shot. And then Squatch mocked me for it at the time and proceeded to mock me for the rest of the season.
I mean, my Key Arena on the court story, I think I told this earlier this year at some point, was during a Storm game where I dressed up as a Sparks fan for one of those in-game promotions. And we had previously pre-taped like this video earlier that day where Squatch like locks me outside of the arena,
mm-hmm.
outside of one of the exits. And I was blindfolded.
This would be a Doppler then?
Yes, Doppler, good point. I was blindfolded, and I legitimately couldn't see. And so like the crowd was like, it was one of those things where it's like cheer for them going towards a specific spot. And they were supposed to, and I was supposed to just run off the court, but I legitimately couldn't see. And I just kind of ran around like crazily. It ended up being very funny, but we lost the pre-taped scene that never got aired.
Oh, because you didn't run off the court?
Yeah, I like spent the entire time out like just walking around like aimlessly. It must have been pretty hilarious.
I think there's a thing where they used to do the player comparisons with like think people who looked like other people, and it was Andres Biedrins and who, the Iceman from, or was it Ivan Drago? Do you remember this?
Probably Drago.
Ivan Drago, and it was like a thing that we had talked about, and then it was on the actual like Key Arena broad, like in game. I mean, being able to know somebody who worked for the team and feel like you have like this weird influence over what's happening at various times. It's like, it's
did
almost,
I pass that along?
Yeah, you pass it along.
Okay.
It's like breaking the fourth wall of sports.
Huh.
Whatever, kind of being able to peer behind. Anyway, it was great all the way through the end. Like there are games. Okay. So this is another very random memory, but the other good thing is, there was a game against Allen Iverson was my favorite player growing up, right?
Yep. I remember this one.
And are you thinking of a different one? Are we talking about Jerry Stackhouse or Allen Iverson?
I'm talking about Allen Iverson.
And there was a random game. We're probably talking about different things where he was playing for the Nuggets. And it's like, I completely lost any interest in Allen Iverson at that point. And he came into Key Arena and balled so hard. Do you remember this?
I remember the Nuggets like beating the Sonics a lot that year.
2003 or something.
No, this was in like 2006.
When he was on the Nuggets?
Yeah.
Okay. And I was just like, oh my God, I still love Allen Iverson. You just go to like a random game and something magical can happen at any time. Or like, I remember comebacks. Like the best feeling was a game that you're down like 15 points. And then I think there was one of these like near the end. I remember there definitely were some in the 04-05, 03-04. Where the team was down like 15 and then just like a sluggish Sunday night, because they always were, and then they just get it going. Ray would hit a couple threes and they get it going, and then you come back and win and you're just like, I am so engaged in this game all of a sudden.
Yeah. You remember Desmond Mason's tip dunk to send the game to overtime?
That was in the snow.
That was in the snow.
It snowed that year. or that game, and I think we had school off the next day. That's when Katie became a Desmond Mason fan.
That was very sad when he got traded.
That was the moment that Katie became Desmond Mason. Also, though, right in front of our seats, we had random seats for this game.
I like that. Like at the start, you were like, "I don't know. I'm not prepared for this Keyring of memories." And then all of the, we spent 20 plus minutes on it.
There was the game. Who was the person that fought with Ray? Because it wasn't Bruce Bowen, was it?
No, it was. It was Keon Dooling.
Yeah, Keon Dooling, right in front of us, and like Ray threw a punch.
Yeah,
right?
Oh yeah, he got suspended.
Where I think Keon Dooling tackled Ray while he was shooting a three in the corner. And it just happened to be right in front of us.
That one spilled into the crowd a little bit. I was very worried because that wasn't very long after the Malice in the Palace. My distinct memory of that fight is I was chatting with David Locke and like asking him, so like, what do I say about this on the team website? There's not been a fight in a game before. That was a new one.
Yeah. I mean, there were tiffs at various times, but Ray was a little bit feisty.
Well, that actually would have been a good story to tell on the pod because of the fact that Keon Dooling, so there's like, you know, there was the whole story last year about the secret hallway at Staples, which actually isn't secret. Mm-hmm. There's a hallway that connects the two teams' locker rooms at Key Arena, and Keon Dooling tried to go from, I believe he was playing for the Magic at that point, the Magic locker room to the Sonics locker room.
Oh, he was ready to fight.
To fight Ray Allen.
There we go.
With security intervened.
right? Because he tackled Ray when he was shooting a three, and then Ray just turned and punched him.
Yeah. I mean, that had been going on for a little bit. He wasn't like completely out of nowhere.
But it was right in front of us, and to see, it's just like, honestly, when there's a fight, the baseball's like this too.
Oh, yeah.
When a fight happens, it's the best moment.
When the Mariners and Yankees fought.
Oh, John Marzano. No yeah. better moment than John R.I.P. Marzano punching Paul O'Neill. But
really got a field now.
But when you see, just seeing that in front of you, because you're just watching a basketball game, right? Your guard's down, and then it's just like, poof, like you feel like you get this like fight or flight reaction to it, even watching the game. Just like, whoa, what just happened there? And so that we randomly were sitting in these weird seats, and it was right in front of us.
Okay.
Anyway, Keyring was the best. not even to mention concerts, though.
It's true, which I didn't get into very much in the podcast.
I mean, saw Kanye West there, Jay-Z there,
Springsteen.
Oh yeah, Bruce. Oh God, Bruce is so good there.
So good there. Not as good at the acoustic show I saw that you didn't go to.
Yeah, you went to two Bruce shows.
You didn't go to McCartney, did he? Did you?
Who?
McCartney?
Not there. I saw Paul McCartney at Safeco.
Right.
There were numerous others. I mean, and then also at Bumbershoot, tons of things. So seeing Macklemore, you know, the first time there were Macklemore breakout shows. To me, the first real Macklemore breakout shows were at the Showbox when he did 1+1+1. And Sir Mix-a-Lot came out and anointed him the new king of Seattle. But then I think it was later that summer opening for Wiz Khalifa. And it was like, Wiz Khalifa did not matter. Right? It was like, this is, and it didn't, I don't know if they counted that one in Macklemore's sold out shows in the banner. But it was like that.
Which
that
came
was,
down at some point. I don't know when.
He brought out Sean Kemp. Sean Kemp didn't do anything, but he just brought out Sean Kemp. And it's like, how is Wiz Khalifa going to compete with this? He's got a Steelers song. Like, come on. Yeah, that was pretty incredible. And Kanye, when right after the, I think this was on the graduation tour, when he had like a spaceship behind him, it was with the stunner shades, Kanye at the time. Key Arena was honestly like one of the better venues for stuff like that. Well, also Kanye,
the acoustics stage are not great for.
But it's all about the sight lines.
Yes.
Like you could be anywhere, and we had pretty good seats for both Jay-Z and for Kanye.
But the last Macklemore concert, we were not many more than one row from the top of the arena, and it was still
good.
Great.
Still yeah. good. It, also, Kanye with the rotating, with the floating stage last year too, which you were gone for some reason.
Yeah, I was back in Connecticut at that point.
like you live in Connecticut.
that is not accurate.
But I might have seen Kanye. Actually, I've seen Kanye three times at Key Arena. So there was I think this was the Yeezus tour where he had like a giant mountain and went on. It was like the first show of the tour and they got there super late. And I think one of their semis was stolen beforehand.
I think this was the night that Mom and I were babysitting for you.
And it went insanely late. Everybody so late. Left. And I was like, I'm not leaving this. I'm like, this is one of the most brilliant things that I've ever seen. Kanye could go on till 5 a.m. and I will be watching Kanye till the bitter end. But then the floating stage, there was tons of stuff. Ah, Key Arena was great.
I feel like I have a little Stockholm syndrome of Key Arena. Like, I just spent so much time there. So I added it up recently.
You did the math.
I estimate that I went to over 800 games all told at Key Arena, including more than 400 Sonics games. I have a pretty good sense of how many Storm games I've went to. Because like the early Sonic seasons, I just estimated that I went 20. To slightly more than half of them.
Well, I guess you have to count the playoffs, though. Did you add
that in? Yeah. I know how many playoff games I've been to at Key Arena. The regular season ones, like those.
You counted all the playoff games?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Wow. You really did do the math here.
Which is only 16, by the way. I've been to more Storm playoff games at Key Arena than Sonics games.
You only went to 16 playoff games at Key Arena?
Yeah.
Wow.
We sold a lot of those tickets. And also, they didn't go to the playoffs.
We sold them?
Yeah.
Which games?
Like, most of the games in 96 we sold.
Huh.
The first couple of rounds. I didn't go to a game either the first two rounds in 96.
Who did we play in the first two rounds in 96?
Sacramento and Houston.
And we sold the tickets?
Yeah.
It's probably, they're probably like 20-some dollars.
But it made up for a lot of the cost of it.
It's crazy.
But anyway, I estimate that, I have a pretty good estimate that I went to 281 Storm games. And then there's also like, I'm doing the math off the top of my head here, like 100 basically other events, a bunch of Pac-12 women's basketball tournament games. I did not make it to Wii Day. The two NCAA tournaments, including I saw both Gonzaga and Stanford get upset the same day in 2004. That was a memorable one. The Big Three, many Gonzaga battles in Seattle, some of which were good and some of which were not.
Seattle U. Did you ever go see Seattle U?
I did. I mean, I went to a bunch of their games one season because I was writing like feature stories about Seattle U. The NCAA Volleyball Final Four I went to at Key Arena.
Oh my God.
A few charity games. There was a Gary Payton charity game that we went to in like 2001. I don't know if you remember that.
I have no recollection of that game. Are you counting preseason games, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
Of course you are.
There was a charity game during the lockout that I went to.
I don't think I
And then that. Also, in addition to the Big Three, there was another experimental 3-on-3 basketball league that played at Key Arena one time where Sean Kemp played, that called the 3BA.
Was it Key Arena or was that Heked when we went to the 11-foot hoop game?
That was Heked.
Oh God, that was bad.
So there's a lot of memories. I'm really Friday is going to be very emotional, I think.
Where do you think you rank all time on events attended at Key Arena?
This is a great question. I mean, the fact that...
Great question.
I mean, let's see. If you had just done all the Sonics games at Key Arena, it still wouldn't be as many as me. So it'd have to be someone who was doing... I think Ushers, who did both Sonics and Storm and the concerts, they probably, and other stuff, they probably rank ahead of me. So I don't know. I think I'm probably solidly in the top 25 of events seen at Key Arena, games seen at Key Arena. Events is higher. I'm lower.
You're right, because we're only counting the Key Arena era. So people who are older and had been to the Coliseum or whatever.
Right. Yeah, to me, they're distinct eras.
So you pretty much, for the Sonics, you went to basically every game for a good chunk of their time period, half of them for a few years.
I mean, I have this here. I missed one Sonics game in the last six seasons they played at Key Arena.
What game?
It was when we were in Mexico. Sonics versus Nuggets, for the record, in December 2004.
Did you watch it on TV?
We did watch it on TV.
Of course.
I mean...
That's pretty amazing. Top 25 all the time. What about, and people who worked for the team kind of came and went or wouldn't have gone to, like, where do you,
or wouldn't necessarily have stayed for the Storm after the Sonics. I mean, in the Storm between 2002 and 2012, which was my last year working for the Storm, I missed three Storm games in that entire span.
And you still went to them through,
or like, I'm sorry, two Storm games in that
you
span.
Didn't miss that many even after.
I've missed a decent number since then. I've been a little over half.
Were there any employees who worked for the Sonics for the tenure that you were there and then worked for the Storm?
Not the whole time.
So you outlasted basically everybody.
Yeah, I mean, there's some people who came back after I left and have stayed there, so they're probably close. But, I mean, Again, I'm hard to beat.
That's pretty amazing. Plus with all the other stuff.
Yeah.
And including, who did we watch? Oh my God, that rapper that we watched, who has the one eye. Oh my God.
I have no idea what you're talking
about. You and me watched a rapper at Bumbershoot like 3 years ago. He does that song Trap Queen. Do you remember this? Yeah, I swear you were there.
Fetty Wap?
Maybe you were not there for Fetty Wap?
I might have been there for Fetty Wap.
I think I was
there for Fetty Wap. I guess it wasn't that memorable.
We saw some very random stuff during Bumper Shoot.
That is true.
I mean, I saw Hall & Oates there with Jan. The amount of times that I was at Kirina with our mom was very notable. I feel like I'm pretty high up there. Obviously, I didn't go to basically any Storm games. I'm in the top 10 percentile.
Yeah, I think so. Of all people. But you will be missing the final event. Again, Kings Warriors this Friday, 7:30 p.m. on ESPN. A great opportunity for Sonics fans to show a national audience how much we deserve to have a team back. Not that deserve has anything to do with it.
And also not that it matters.
But still. Well, you know what team is one step closer to reality?
Are we not going to talk about Shake Shack beforehand?
Oh, I guess yes. All right, fine.
We need to talk about Shake Shack. No, it was a good transition, but...
Friday night, final event ever at Key Arena. Is one door is closing. Another door is opening. Because Saturday at 11 a.m., Shake Shack is coming to Seattle.
Wow.
At long last, we have been anticipating this for more than a year. Since when we were searching for Seattle's best burr. And now it's finally here, and you're never going to possibly be able to go there because it's going to be so crowded.
I don't think it's going to be crowded for that long.
It's going to be crowded. It's going to be crowded for a long time.
Okay, can you describe to me exactly where Shake Shack is?
I've looked this up several times, and I feel like the answer is still no.
The Google Maps on the iPad is not loading for me.
I think that it's it's by the Whole Foods.
Okay.
On Westlake.
Okay.
I think.
So it's not too far from that great state. Right in the heart of Amazon land.
I guess it's not actually there. It definitely is not actually there. It is on Westlake, but farther south.
So you think if we meet there for some random day for lunch, you think it's going to be that crazy?
Yes. Yes. I mean, you still can't park at the Chick-fil-A in Bellevue.
Oh.
And that's been open for 4 years now.
I've been to the Chick-fil-A in Bellevue, and I will tell you that A, there are times you can go there where there's basically no line. B, they design it, that Chick-fil-A, such that they are creating a bigger line than they need to.
Fine. It's still very busy.
Shake Shack will not do that.
I mean, when I went there on a Friday night, it was extraordinarily busy.
So you went there
years
on a
afterwards.
Super busy time?
Yes. Years, but you're talking about lunchtime, and that's going to be the busiest time for this place because it's right by literally all of the tech workers in the city.
Okay, so we need to figure out the exact right time to not have to see a single tech worker.
Well, the weekend, first off. But 3 p.m. 3 p.m. on a Tuesday, I feel like, is the best time to go there.
3 p.m. on a Tuesday?
Yeah.
I'll see you there.
Okay. It's a
day. Not on this Tuesday or the next Tuesday, but I'll see you there in November.
Do we want to talk about the Seattle touches at the Shake Shack?
Of course we do.
From the Eater article on the opening date and the menu. Seattle's special burger is the Montlake Double Cut featuring...
You know, nobody's talking about how the Pelton cast should have been invited to sort of sneak peeks that the Shake Shack is doing.
There's still time. There's still time. Anyway, featuring...
That invite is not coming.
Local beef with Beecher's Just Jack cheese, caramelized onions, and a whole grain mustard mayo on a Macrina Bakery bun. It's, quote, a bit bigger than the standard Shack burger. The Montlake Double Cut is the first time one of the international chain's specialty burgers has used a patty, cheese, and bun entirely from local purveyors. The end result will be available only at the restaurant, only in limited quantities
each
day.
What does that mean, only at the restaurant?
Not, delivery.
So why don't we just get delivery Shake Shack?
I don't know how difficult that will be, but yes, that actually is the play. That's the sneak. And it probably doesn't qualify as a sneak because it's too obvious, but that is the sneak.
Okay, can I give a review of that burger? It kind of sounds gross.
Yeah, I'd much rather have just a regular Shack
give
burger.
Give me a Shack burger.
On the utterly decadent sweet side, a coffee and croissant concrete features Seawolf Baker's croissant brittle and chunks of Theodark chocolate swirled with coffee caramel sauce into vanilla custard, while the Shack Attack concrete has a base of chocolate custard mixed with those chunks of Theodark chocolate again. That's my play, that right there. Plus fudge sauce, chocolate truffle cookie dough, and chocolate sprinkles. And then the Pie Oh My concrete will mix an entire seasonal slice from a la mode pies into vanilla custard.
Nice. Well, shouts to Brian Larson on Google, who gave a review of the restaurant already. It says the best burger on the planet 11 hours ago.
Okay. There you go.
Why do you think that this Shake Shack will be so busy, but you can go into Vegas at basically any time and it's not that busy?
Number one, that's been an open for a couple years now.
Okay.
Number two, there are a lot of burger options in Vegas.
I mean, there's a lot of burger options in Seattle?
I mean, there's going to be a huge amount of novelty to this place.
It is awfully close to Amazon.
Yeah. I mean, particularly at lunchtime, it is going to be crazy. Dinner time might not be as crazy, given that
it's just dead down there around dinner time.
Yes.
I honestly wish it was in basically any other part of town, but also the Montlake Double, they're not that close to Montlake.
True.
Couldn't they have called it the Westlake Double?
That's fair.
Anyway, this is the kind of insight they would have gotten had they invited the Pelton cast to some sort of opening party, soft opening, friends and family opening. Yeah, yeah, being involved in the planning process.
We are very available.
We've designed a burger now. Like, we know what we're doing here.
That is all accurate.
But at the same time, the first time that we can have some cheese fries. Huh. Which airport is it in New York City?
JFK.
JFK.
Yes.
Do we know what terminal?
I do not know. There's two of them, I think, right? Yeah, there's multiple terminals.
Okay, so I'm flying to JFK on Friday, right? Thursday. I'm actually flying there on Thursday.
Hopefully you know.
I could go to Shake Shack in JFK. I'm doing it.
Okay.
Because I'm all fired up about these cheese fries.
Interesting that the fries are what you're most fired
up about.
They're
so good. The burger's good. Honestly, Shake Shack right now, hands down, better than In-N-Out.
Why choose?
But also, it's better than that. Overall, the whole package.
I'm not ready to quite go that far.
This is a big weekend. So, as one door closes with Key Arena, two doors open.
Ah, that's a good one. Because we may not have the Sonics, but we are one step closer to an NHL expansion team. After on Tuesday, the NHL Seattle and Oakview groups presented to the NHL Executive Committee and received a unanimous recommendation to award Seattle an expansion franchise. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman says the full board of governors of owners, 31 owners, is expected to approve the expansion team either December 3rd or 4th at the next board of governors meetings. And Bettman now made it sound a little bit more like 2020 rather than 2021 for the team to start play. The focus for everybody is 2020, Bettman said Tuesday. That's what we're focused on. There are a variety of factors that could impact that, including the construction timeline. The sooner construction can begin, obviously, the more likely an early start. He also said separately, if everything can be accomplished, then 2020 will be the goal. If not, then we'll go with 2021. But I think everybody's preference would be sooner rather than later. And I think that was, you know, well, not a key part of the pitch. That was something that was apparently emphasized by the Seattle delegation, which also included Mayor Jenny Durkin. And, you know, the other variety of factors that he mentioned there that still does include the possibility of an NHL lockout at the start of the 2020-21 season, which might be a reason to delay things, but it really sounds like it's primarily going to be focused on construction. So right now, the contract that Oakview signed with the city of Seattle says demolition won't begin until the NHL team is actually awarded. So that would be December in this timeline. It's possible, though, that they could you know, assuming that everything remains on track, decide to begin that process a little bit sooner, waive that particular clause, which would be odd because I don't know why they inserted it in the first place, but when we all kind of knew this was a done deal, but, you know, what are you going to do?
Okay.
So, I mean, nothing about this is surprising. We've been telling you all along, as soon as Seattle has an NHL-ready arena, the NHL is coming to Seattle. But, again, good to just kind of check another box in this process with really only one more hurdle left, that being the full Board of Governors vote.
Nobody's considered what this means for a rescheduled Childish Gambino date.
They have not, no.
And it means that there's not going to be one.
It means that it's canceled, sadly.
But again, hockey is coming to Seattle. And hockey is coming to Seattle maybe a little bit sooner than we expected.
Yeah.
So that would be two seasons, right? Because we're going into the 2018-19 season.
Which starts on Wednesday.
Really?
Hockey starts really early.
That starts way too early.
I mean, the basketball starts way too early now, but hockey starts way, way too early.
You talked about the fall beer creep. You should be concerned with the fall sport creep.
It's meaning a lot more overlap between the NBA season and like the NFL season, and I'm not excited about that.
I don't. You could play. They would never do this. You could have played six less games or something, maybe even less than that, and then just started around Halloween when basketball is supposed to start.
Yeah, not gonna happen. Do you want another classic Paltoncast tradition?
Oh yeah.
Speaking of seasons that are too long,
there we go.
The MLS. Where the Seattle Sounders have four games remaining after last Saturday, coming up with a 4-0 win over the Colorado Rapids, really erasing the bad memories of the two-game losing streak they had after their long 9-game winning streak. This was a match the Sounders dominated nearly as much as the final score. They beat the Rapids 2.6 to 0.2 in shot-based expected goals, according to 538's model, and 2.5 to 0.2 in non-shot expected goals. And that is a really low number of expected goals for Colorado. The Sounders got a brace from Raul Ruiz Diaz, plus a Nicola Ladero penalty, and another goal, an insurance goal from Victor Rodriguez later in this match. The Sounders now up to fourth in the Western Conference in points per match, 1 point back of Portland for fourth in the standings, with a match in hand over the rival Timbers, and 3 points back of LAFC for third. Those two teams have played the same number of games. The Sounders' playoff odds now up to 99%.
There we go.
Right, continuing the trend, of course, of the Sounders and Mariners being completely opposite.
The Mariners
all season.
Are now, as far as I understand it, 0%.
They are. This weekend, the Sounders will host the Houston Dynamo on Monday at CenturyLink Field. Houston comes in 10th in the Western Conference standings, but that really underestimates how difficult this game is. They have a +5 goal differential on the season and somehow are 10th in the West. And even that's kind of unlucky. They have the 6th best expected goal differential in all of MLS, according to American Soccer Analysis. The Dynamo also come in playing well lately. They have 3 wins in their last 4 matches. They've gotten a lot of offensive production from their forward line, which includes Mauro Manotas with 15 goals, Albert Ellis with 11 goals, 9 assists, and Romel Kyoto with 11 assists and 5 goals this season.
So the Sounders could lose this match.
I mean, playing at home, I think it's unlikely that it's a full loss, but... You know, not kind of the sure thing. If you look, we talked last week about how easy their schedule is in terms of playing teams that are out of playoff contention the rest of the way. But they play Houston both home and home over these last 4 matches. And those are not, in fact, as easy as they might appear.
But if they win, they're almost certainly in 4th place in the Western Conference.
Yes.
Which means what?
I mean, that would mean hosting one of the play-in games. So 3rd and 4th host one of the play-in games. 5th and 6th go on the road for those one-game play-ins.
And 2nd is pretty much out of the question?
2nd is out of the question at this point. It would be extremely unlikely they could get any higher than 3rd. And even 3rd is looking like a challenge. And there's not a huge difference 3rd versus 4th at this point. That just would change the quality of the opponent you play in those matches and then potentially down the road in the semifinals.
So the way it's set up is they play one game, 4-5.
Yes.
Assuming the Sounders get the 4th seed. Yes. Could be the Derby match.
It could be.
Wow. Which would be pretty dramatic, and you want that match in Seattle.
Absolutely. Yeah, so 4th versus 5th.
I meant the Derby match, Seattle versus Houston.
I mean, third versus second is obviously probably the biggest swing in the MLS playoffs. But after that, it's fourth versus fifth, getting the chance to host that one game playoff instead of going on the road.
So they play one match to have the privilege to play, if you're the four seed, the one seed in a home and home.
Yes.
Okay.
Which I think is about where they were in 2016.
It's not a bad place to be then.
No. And obviously a strong finishing kick, much like 2016. All right, we turn our attention now to Husky football. Coming off a 35-7 win on Saturday over then number 20 BYU. We told you that BYU was overrated. It turns out even we may have given BYU wow. a little bit too much respect, as these Huskies completely dominated this game from start until Chico McClatcher dropped a punt with like 3 minutes left and ruined the shutout.
I mean, this was, we went into the game expecting to win.
Yes.
This was maybe one of the most impressive performances of the Chris Peterson era.
It was just a complete domination. And BYU is just not that good of a team anymore. At this point, if you look in Football Power Index, they've dropped to where they would be, I think, 11th out of the... It would be 13 teams if somehow they were in the Pac-12. So this is at the low end of the competition the Huskies are going to face the rest of the way. But still, to be this dominant, double them up, I think, in terms of yardage.
It was a 35-7 victory that wasn't as close as the score would indicate.
Yes.
I mean, this could have easily been a 50-0 victory.
I don't know about 50, but it certainly could have easily been 35-0 and, you know, maybe 42-0 or something like that. The highlight of this game, Jake Browning becoming UW's all-time leader in passing yards, passing Cody Pickett, pun intended there, no pun intended, Browning already the all-time leader in touchdowns. He broke the record on 208 fewer pass attempts than Cody Pickett, meaning that Browning has 8.4 yards per attempt in his career to Pickett's 7.2.
And Jake Haner would have broken it on like 100.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
On like 300 fewer pass attempts.
And Browning did it in style, going 23 of 25 in terms of completions against BYU, the second highest completion percentage in Pac-12 history, trailing only Rick Neuheisel, who went 25 of 27 for UCLA against UW.
Wow.
In 1983.
Okay. This was another amazing Jake game. Like, the haters are not out.
They're very silent right now.
The haters are silent. Jake played basically a perfect game of football. I think did he have a perfect passer rating in this game?
Probably.
I mean, this was...
really don't pay attention to passer
rating. It doesn't matter, but I'm saying...
He had the 19th best QBR in any game this season.
In all of college football?
Yep.
That's pretty good.
That's very good.
And more so, it wasn't like Jake was necessarily putting the team on his back. It was just Jake was efficient in every single thing he did.
I mean, it was a very Jake Browning performance. Like, obviously, it's the archetypal Jake Browning performance.
But also the rushing touchdown in there.
Yeah.
There's the spry Jake Browning in this one.
But it's also like everything that Jake Browning doesn't get enough credit for, because people pay too much attention to his arm strength and not enough attention to his accuracy and decision making. That is the reason he has the highest completion percentage in UW football history.
Overrated. I mean, we had talked about how the thing that Chris Peterson does really well is not, he doesn't play up for the big games and he doesn't necessarily let down for the small games. But the thing that Chris Peterson does really well is he wins all of the medium games by a lot.
Yep.
And this was a medium game, and Chris Peterson and the Husky team in general destroyed BYU.
That is accurate. So this weekend, the Huskies will head out on the road for the first of a two-game road trip. And this one takes them to the struggling UCLA Bruins, who are 0-4 so far under their first-year head coach, Chip Kelly. The Bruins come in ranked 74th in Football Power Index and have lost their last three games by a combined 74 points, including a 38-16 loss at Colorado in their Pac-12 opener last weekend. I do think this game is maybe a little scarier than it looks on paper. Because a lot of the reason the Bruins have struggled this year, they have, if you look at Football Power Index efficiency, the 116th rated offense in NCAA Division I, which is out of only 130
teams. Sounds scary.
Just three Power Conference teams have been worse so far. But the big reason for that is their true freshman quarterback, Dorian Thompson. Wait. Wrote that down wrong.
His name isn't actually Dorian Thompson Thompson.
It is not.
I was like, wow. A bold move to hyphenate Thompson with Thompson instead of just going with Thompson.
Their true freshman quarterback, Dorian Thompson Robinson, who was forced into action early this season, has completed 53% of his passes for 6.0 yards per attempt. Now, if you look at Jake Browning's career out of, I believe, 44 games, he has six career games where he's completed worse than 53% of his passes. Thompson Robinson ranks 125th in QBR out of 131 qualified quarterbacks. He's been sacked on 11% of his dropbacks, which is sixth most among quarterbacks with at least 100 dropbacks. But the reason he's playing is because Michigan grad transfer Wilton Spate, who was the starter at the beginning of the season, left the opening game with a back injury. He has been cleared to play, was cleared to play last weekend against Colorado, didn't see any action, but it's possible that he could be the starter this weekend against the Huskies, and I think that would make UCLA substantially more competitive in this game, even though Spate didn't really perform that well. He completed 8 of 12 passes in the opening game before getting injured. That was against Cincinnati, but for just 3.8 yards per attempt.
3.8.
But you look at his career, he's 59% completions, mostly at Michigan.
Wilton Spate is a competent quarterback.
Yes, and Thompson Robinson's just, like, he was thrown in way too early. He wasn't ready to play.
So you're saying that we should be a little bit afraid of Wilton Spate?
Just a little bit.
Okay.
And so here's the other thing is, and it's tough to say how much this is because of their dismal passing attack. UCLA, because Chip Kelly, as we know, is really a run-oriented coach.
Yes.
Much more so than a pass-oriented coach. They're running the ball on 53% of their plays, despite the fact that they've trailed basically all the time this season. But they're averaging just 3.9 yards per carry. Their lead running back, Bulu Olorunfunmi, has averaged 2.7 yards per carry. Last Saturday at Colorado, or last Friday, rather, at Colorado, Joshua Kelly stepped up with 12 carries for 124 yards, and we'd expect him to see more action this weekend after that strong performance. Also offensively, watch out for their 6'5" freshman wide receiver, Michael Ezeke, in the red zone. Both of his catches this season have gone for touchdowns. That's two of their three this season.
There you go. What is happening?
I mean, UCLA is getting... I mean, clearly this is a major transition for UCLA to Chip Kelly's system. He doesn't have his players yet in there. I mean, I think the hope is that Thompson Robinson, who was a really highly regarded recruit, eventually is going to be this player. But stop me if you've heard this before. It's really hard for true freshman quarterbacks to succeed in college football.
I don't like the sound of that. Doesn't sound right.
Does not check out.
Play Jake. But really, what is happening? Like, when was the last time Chip Kelly was good?
I mean, midway through his second season with the Eagles, he was certainly good.
What year do you think that was?
Was it the year the Seahawks won the Super Bowl or the year after they won the Super Bowl? I think it was 2014.
You think he was good as recently as 2014?
Yeah, and before Mark Sanchez came in as the quarterback. Remember when Nick Foles was riding high? Oh, what a time it was to be alive when Nick Foles was playing well.
Do you think that there's any element of Chip Kelly had a very effective offense for a very specific time period in football, and that time period just doesn't exist anymore?
I mean, we can't rule that out. It's certainly possible. I don't think that's the case, personally. I think his issue in Philadelphia was much less his scheme and much more his decision-making as a general manager. And I don't think that will be the same kind of problem for him at the college level because it wasn't beforehand.
You know he was a coach somewhere else in between.
Yeah, he had a terrible roster in San Francisco.
It's just, it feels like if you can only be a good coach with an excellent roster, it's like, great. A lot of people can be good coaches with excellent rosters.
But this is in the NFL. College is a different game. And well, I mean, in football, often the more progressive offenses start at the college level and then matriculate to the NBA, to the NFL, rather than, you know, the NBA, where like clearly the coaching is so much better in the NBA than it is in college. Still, I think that Chip's system is more likely to be successful at the college level. They were 6-2 with Nick Foles as a starter in 2014.
There we go.
And this is Nick Foles we're talking about.
Hey, Nick Foles, this is Super Bowl champion Nick Foles.
It sure
Thank you very much, sir.
It sure is.
Anyway, just looking at this, I mean, clearly it's not going to happen right away. This is, you would be taking a giant leap of faith to say that it's ever going to turn around for UCLA.
Ever?
Yeah.
Ever?
Because also, you know what happens when you lose this badly? You don't recruit as well.
Granted, I know. Just sometimes recruits think, I can play right away. Especially if you come in and you're a Chip Kelly guy, as opposed to the old guy who was recruited by the previous regime, is not. Chip Kelly just inherited.
Man, that previous regime, though. Am I right? Dodged a bullet there.
Don't have time to get into those takes. But we talked for like an hour about Kyrie.
Anyway, I mean, this is a game where, again, we've talked about this for a few weeks in a row. The Huskies are probably better at every single position.
Yes.
You know, I don't know exactly what happened, considering that Jim Mora was supposed to come into Washington and recruit exceptionally well, why UCLA is completely devoid of talent on the roster.
But it's just not fit for a Chip Kelly system. They're doing totally different things.
There can't be
Also, they did lose a quarterback who started a game against the Seahawks last week and played well.
No, I mean, obviously, like, it makes some sense why they would be worse, but this bad doesn't make sense.
The other thing, by the way, you know who UCLA probably wishes it had is KJ Carter Samuels. I haven't checked in on KJ Carter Samuels' stats in a while, but I guarantee
Wait,
you...
where's he at?
Colorado State. I guarantee you they're better than Dorian Thompson-Robinson's stats.
Well, they went with Wilton Spate. You wouldn't have signed both Wilton Spate and KJ Carter Samuels.
I mean, they would have probably, but KJ Carter Samuels wasn't interested in it.
But this is a team.
He is completing 63% of his passes for 7.7 yards per attempt so far.
Where the Huskies, honestly, seeing the Huskies as the number 18 defense in FPI is a little bit surprising, because this is a top 10 defense.
You know, the interesting thing I meant to get to is that FPI now has the Huskies almost as effective offensively, number 21, as defensively, number 18. Which is interesting.
And seeing this UCLA offense, which has been so ineffective this season, going against this Husky defense, they don't stand much of a chance here.
But UCLA is still, like, they haven't been blown out that badly this season.
Go and look at these scores.
I mean, they lost by 28 at Oklahoma. And for the Huskies to be favored by 21 in this game feels like too many points to me. Granted, they did lose to Fresno at home by 24. But particularly if Wilton
Spade
is back.
High spreads scare me all the time.
Yes.
Do I think that the Huskies are going to cover a 21-point spread? Maybe not. Are the Huskies going to win this game? Yes.
I agree with that.
What would you put? I would put the percentage chances of winning at like 95%.
I would probably say 90. FBI only says 93 in this, or 92 in this one.
Which is a little less
than BYU last week at 93.
Did you see that the last time the Huskies won in UCLA was like 1996?
I did not see that. It doesn't feel like the Huskies play at the Rose Bowl very often.
I mean, I cannot remember a game there except for Marcus Tuiasosopo playing there. That's yes. The only game that I can remember at UCLA.
I mean, they wouldn't have played them.
Maurice Jones-Drew, was that there when he went off in like probably 2000 or something? I think that was there.
No, that was here.
That was here. Great.
That was definitely here.
Good news. It's been an exceptionally long time since the Huskies have won at UCLA. Fortunately, this is the best possible situation for them to be going there.
But I mean, the schedule is kind of set up strangely because this is Coach Pete's first trip to UCLA in his fifth year as the Husky head coach. So that's kind of odd. They played UCLA at home in 14, then USC the 2 years after that. So, therefore, by process of elimination, they played there at UCLA in 2013, and that was the Miles Jack game that they lost 41-31.
Miles Jack game?
Yeah, he scored a touchdown? Maybe two?
Yeah, he was kind of a beast in that game, right? Oh, he was playing on offense.
Oh, I'm sorry. He scored four touchdowns in that game. That right? definitely
he ran
was
for like a 50-yard touchdown in that game.
No, they were all short, but he ran for 4 touchdowns in that game.
Oh my God.
Oh boy.
Times are different now. Everything's okay. Miles Jack probably would not. A defensive player probably would not run for 4 touchdowns against this current Husky defense.
That just seem unlikely. You know who was the quarterback that day for UCLA?
I have no idea.
It's current Seahawks backup, Brett Hundley.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah. Who also threw for 2 touchdowns on top of those 4 Miles Jack touchdown runs.
This was a Sark game, right?
It was a Sark game.
Okay. Well, anyway.
I mean, UCLA was good. They were number 13 in the country at that point. So,
Chris Peterson's first game at UCLA, and I think this will be Chris Peterson's first win at UCLA.
It does seem likely. Also, we didn't mention UCLA allowing opponents to complete a conference high 64.5% of their passes. So you put that with Jake Browning last week. I mean,
he's completing 130% of his passes.
The magic, the math checks out. The math checks out. All right, let's talk Seahawks. Wait, we didn't pour one out at the start. And that was a mistake.
I'm going to go get one to pour out.
To Earl Thomas, the end of his season, and quite likely, it seems, the end of his Seahawks career on a field that has been a house of horrors for the Seahawks, despite the fact that they almost always seem to win there, at least during the regular season.
I remember a time they didn't win there.
Yes. Is it still University of Phoenix Stadium?
This week, like every week as a Seahawks fan, really sucked. I mean,
this one sucked for in a different way. A different, more emotional way.
It was just rough to watch, right? Like, aside from the fact that we love Earl and he's one of the greatest Seahawks we will ever witness play.
Undoubtedly.
I mean, he must be probably in the top 5 as far as level of play relative to the league of Seahawks we have seen.
I mean, it's not like there's that many before. I mean, I guess it depends how highly you think of Kenny Easley, but I think Steve Largent would be the only one before
our time.
We have
seen, though.
Yeah.
Cortez Kennedy.
But I'm saying there's not that many even before that.
Yeah. So.
Walter Jones. Earl. That's probably the list, right?
I mean, I still would put Russell on that list, but.
Relative to position?
Oh, my God. I was looking at my 8th to 15th best quarterback, and I'm like, I was right. And I'm like, I was right.
You know, whispering doesn't really work well on the podcast.
I don't want everybody to know.
Okay.
But you can count 7 quarterbacks who are playing better than Russell right now. Anyway.
I mean, quarterback performances depend on many things, including offensive coordinator, offensive line,
yes.
Wide receiver talent.
Sure.
Whether you actually run play action. But we're going to get to that. That's not time for that yet. Yeah. I mean, just everything about this sucks. The timing in terms of the Seahawks not trading him sucks. The timing in terms of him going into free agency coming off this injury sucks. Everything about it sucks. Nobody wins here. Yep. There are no winners here.
It sucks for both the Seahawks, Earl Thomas, the fans, the Chiefs.
Yeah, I'm glad you got to them.
Like every single person involved in the situation it's bad for.
And I'm also bummed out that this whole middle finger thing has like overshadowed everything else because it's become the talking point.
It's overshadowed thing for you press types. I don't know if it's overshadowed things for other people.
It overshadowed things for some people that I saw at was seated near at Beer Star the other week.
God.
Where, by the way, completely randomly enjoyed a lovely Amarillo Fresh Hop from what was that brewery?
I would much rather talk about that than the Earl Thomas injury. So take your time here. And the people, real human beings.
Hellbent Brewing Company in Lake City. It was
in Lake City.
Now I'm going to whisper.
Better than Field to Ferment. Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
The crisp burritos were very good too. I got in on a second time on those.
Were they better the second time?
I think they were. They had like perfected them more by the end of the week.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
Makes sense.
They'd been making them for 7 days, so. Right. I understand why they would have perfected the Taco Time's only been doing it for 50 years. Anyway, They were great. I would eat a crisp burrito right this second.
Oh, man, I could go for
starving.
A crisp burrito.
Talked about Shake Shack. Anyway, so Shake Shack is going to be so good. Right in our hometown.
But I think there is a significant contingent of Seahawks fans for whom that gesture also overshadowed all the real issues that underlie.
Well, the good news is none of them are listening to this podcast.
That is accurate.
A lot of them are listening to sports radio. It's just like, I don't believe that it actually did. Maybe it did for that segment of fans, but who gives a shit, right? Who cares?
It's just like
I'm going to say to you what I said to you yesterday, which is Pete Carroll, who, for all intents and purposes, the Earl Thomas flipping out the sideline was directed at. You argued that this might not have been the case, and it might not have been. But for all
I just
we
don't
know,
think we should put any thoughts in Earl Thomas's head. But that's certainly one of the likely possibilities.
But Pete Carroll, who the middle finger was maybe directed at, is saying cut him some slack. But people from the media at prominent newspapers, this is what I'm allowed to say by the podcast censors, we're sitting right here. Prominent sports radio hosts who may have been interviewing Pete Carroll would have said, but Pete Carroll, who it's directed at, says cut him some slack. It's just like, just give me a fucking break over here.
Again, I'm disappointed that that became the talking point and not the very real issue.
I fucking loved it.
And I'm sick of, I'm kind of sick of hearing, though, about it's because of the current CBA. Like, previous CBAs weren't, like, encouraging teams to sign players. Like, look, as long as you have a salary cap, this is what's going to happen. Not maybe this specifically, but it's the product of a salary cap.
Yes.
The salary cap puts players against fans.
Abolish the salary cap.
Yeah, good luck with that.
That's what you're trying to say, as far as I understand.
It is.
I mean, the thing is, it was actually interesting listening to Pete Carroll on Monday, because I was saying this to you. It's like, Pete Carroll, probably as a human being, would want to re-sign Earl Thomas. Like, and who knows? I think Pete Carroll would probably prefer not to have a salary cap. Of course, every coach would prefer not to have a salary cap.
100%.
But it makes you make these decisions, and the I don't want to say the current climate, because maybe this is all climates, overvalue players on rookie contracts.
I mean, that is somewhat a change because of the fact that the current CBA did put in rookie scales and therefore make those draft picks more valuable. But that to me really just kind of, it's not like there's more draft picks than there were before. That just affects the value of those picks in trade.
Like, well, the good news is we didn't get any of those draft picks in trade.
It is good news. But like veterans, there's actually more money available to pay veterans now than there was before. So because less of it is going to the players on rookie contracts,
yes.
There's more money available to pay veterans. It's just the Seahawks have chosen not to pay that money to Earl Thomas, because if you did that, then how could you pay
Tyler Lockett?
Yeah.
No, really, if Earl Thomas is flipping anybody off, he should probably be flipping Russell Wilson off, because the amount that quarterbacks are getting paid on their second and third contracts after is kind of, that's ballooning when nothing else is.
Yes. I mean, I think part of the issue, I think we talked about this maybe before. First off, we don't know, nobody has reported what the Seahawks actually offered Earl Thomas, or if the Seahawks have even deigned to make Earl Thomas an offer at all.
Yeah.
They may have never even made him an offer, but I think it was always going to be a challenge for them to extend him, because Earl Thomas is looking at his value as, I am one of the very best defensive players in the league. I should be getting paid like Khalil Mack. And even if you take his age out of it, the fact that the safety market is as weak as it is right now was always going to make that an impossibility. And I think that there is a factor where the current team is at a disadvantage in that situation, because the player takes it much more personally when the current team doesn't offer him very much money, and not as personally when other teams don't offer him very much money. So, you know, I think, like, I mean, the Pelicans didn't end up making him an offer in the end, but, you know, at the time he's actually a free agent. But I feel like DeMarcus Cousins is an example of this, where he got hurt and his value went way down, and that made it way less likely that he was going to re-sign with the Pelicans.
So you're saying it's bad to have good players? This is like Pete Carroll-level galaxy brain.
Inception. No, yeah. It's bad to have bad, good players that aren't valued by the market. Like, Russell Wilson is valued by the market. a market that probably would run play action with him every once in a while. They just consider. But Earl Thomas, because of the unique nature of the current safety market, was not likely to be valued. And that's why I think even before this injury...
They would still probably spend a first-round pick on a safety, but not pay Earl.
That's its own issue.
We'll get there in a second.
Even before this injury, I think his contract was likely to be very disappointing for him, and I think that probably will be more so the case now.
I mean, absolutely. But, I mean, honestly, whomever signs Earl for this next contract is probably going to get a steal.
Oh, undoubtedly. The replacement level at safety is pretty high because you can just go and sign Eric Reed off the street, which is its own separate issue. But there are other, like, good safeties.
I mean, that's like saying the replacement level of quarterback is very high because you could sign Colin Kaepernick off the street.
The replacement level of quarterback is very high because you could sign Colin Kaepernick off the street.
One player. There's not another Eric Reed, because adding into this story is that the Seahawks could have signed Eric Reed.
I mean...
And then he got signed the week before Earl got hurt.
I'm actually... Can I give you a hot take? I'm okay with Tedrick Thompson.
Wow.
That's my tech.
I mean, honestly, like, the team probably would have moved on from Earl this week no matter what. I don't know if, let's say he hadn't gotten injured on that play. I think he's still traded this week.
I don't know. The fact that the Seahawks won, I think, makes it less likely that he would have traded this week. I think it would have been more probable that he would have been traded after this week.
50-0.
We'll get to that. The Seahawks...
Earl Thomas, they would have moved on from Earl Thomas relatively soon. We were getting Tedrick Thompson no matter what.
That's probably true. So the Seahawks did add depth at the position to go along with Tedrick Thompson and Delano Hill by... it appears TJ Green has tweeted that he has signed with the Seahawks. He was a 2016 second round pick by the Colts out of Clemson, who was waived by the team earlier this year after playing extensively during his first two seasons, waived, injured, and then an injury settlement, and available now to the Seahawks. So he's okay. Played primarily at free safety.
Okay. So we've talked about Earl. We love you, Earl. We would still extend you if we could. I mean, honestly, like, depending on what the market was, if they could bring Earl back, like, let's say that the market completely dried out and the Seahawks, it's just not happening. Hates the Seahawks now.
Understandably so.
Right? Like, I wish that sucks. Wasn't the case, because whatever he signs for next year, the Seahawks probably would still sign him for it.
It's going to be another Sheldon Richardson situation. Maybe even more extreme Sheldon Richardson situation.
All right, what about the next Seahawks topic?
Well, Will Dissly ruptured his patellar tendon. So that was fun. We can't have nice things.
Backup tight end George Fant.
In a fun fact, Nick Vannett has the third worst DR among tight ends this season. That is partially because he's fumbled on one of his handful of catches.
What was that? I'm trying to remember that fumble.
I can't say I particularly remember it off the top of my head. Oh, the only fumble I remember at this point is David Moore fumbling his way to first down, which is great. The Seahawks currently do not have another tight end on the roster. It briefly appeared like it might cost them a touchdown when they had to use both Joey Hunt and George Fant as eligible receivers, rather, as tight ends in a goal line play, and Hunt did not report to the correct referee, and therefore... created an illegal formation penalty, although the Seahawks did eventually get that one back and Mike Davis did get that touchdown.
I mean, this is more of the same, though. We talk about over and over and over again the Seahawks shooting themselves in the foot.
We're getting to that in a second.
Well, can I just mention Ed Dixon?
I mean, I think the Ed Dixon call was reasonable. Like,
they paid him this offseason as their starting tight end.
No, but they clearly didn't think he was going to be healthy for some of those weeks and didn't want him on the roster inactive all those times.
Because of who? Shalom Luani?
Well, but that did become an issue when they had a bunch of injuries in week two, when Ed Dixon probably would not have been ready. So he will have to miss the next two games. Then he will be eligible to come off the PUP list or NFI. I don't know. Whatever list he's on, he'll be eligible to come
on. He's on a lot of lists.
And in the meantime, the Seahawks will probably re-sign Darrell Daniels off the practice squad to be their number two tight end.
Great.
Which, by the way, the Seahawks skill position talent is not great.
How are they a team that wants to run the ball desperately but only carries two tight ends?
You'd have to talk to them.
I'm going to start tweeting some sharp football stats at them.
In also very sad but more real-world news, Seahawks owner And also Blazers owner Paul Allen announced on Monday the return of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. He previously beat that form of cancer in 2009 and expressed optimism from his doctors about the ability to fight it again this time. And of course, all the best wishes to Paul Allen for a successful recovery, much like Earl Thomas and Will Disley.
And that one coming like right after the game on Sunday. It's just like, God damn.
It was a lot.
It didn't come right after the game, but it came on Monday.
On the heels of it. All right, now it's time to get into what makes the Seahawks so frustrating to watch. And see, the thing here is the answer is it's not that the Seahawks are bad, because although we probably should talk about how many wins we think Earl Thomas will cost them, but the problem isn't necessarily so far that they're bad, because right now they're a 500 team. The problem is they're so self-defeatingly a 500 team in just, it seems like, every way.
They don't need to be this bad.
They're putting roadblocks on their own success.
So we talked about this personnel-wise. I mean, I still feel like the Ed Dixon thing is part of that. If you sign somebody to be your number one tight end...
But it's not like they didn't think Ed Dixon was good. It's because he was injured. They just made a poor choice. And I mean, that's a lot of hindsight.
They make a lot of poor choices.
Like, if Will Disley hadn't gotten hurt, I mean, Will Disley and Nick Vanette would have been fine.
But Will Disley has exceeded expectations.
He has.
Like, had exceeded expectations. Oh, Will Disley. Of all people. Just like, God.
Well, I can think of some people that would have been worse, but...
Well, then, you know, other players, maybe you just bottom out the year.
Yeah,
it's true. A really good draft pick. Will Disley's like, he's like right in between. Like, you love Will Disley and was having a good year, but he's not like, you don't give up on the season because of Will Disley. You probably give up on the season because you're bad. And because of the team they're playing this week. But also, it's still just about the decision-making over and over and over again. It's about trying to do this thing where it's like the 0-for-10 on third downs, right? These are all, they're running the ball, and they're so excited about how they're running the ball. They're pumped and jacked, but also they're in third and six, third and six, third and nine, third and nine. They're not even...
I don't know. There were a fair number of third and fours and 33s in there too, right?
I don't think so. The amount that running the ball gets them into the situation that they feel like they want to be in is not enough to make sense to run the ball.
Which, I mean, it was last week because they ran the ball very successfully, particularly out of read options. And Russell Wilson actually kept the ball, which was very exciting.
Third and six, third and nine, third and nine, third and 22, third and 14, third and five, third and three.
Or there was a third and three.
There were basically what you would consider two makeable third downs in there. This is with running the ball. But we have... I mean,
part of what happened is they actually picked up first downs running the ball without going to third down, which was nice.
But just the sense of the makeable third down. The makeable third down is a myth.
The makeable third down is the third down you don't face at all.
Yeah.
And the real friends were the real third down was the friends we made along the way.
I mean, when you see the Chiefs have, what were they at? Second and 30, I think? First and 30? Pick up 23 yards on first down and then get like 40 yards on second down. It's like they're not concerned with makeable third downs, because makeable third downs are a stupid thing to be concerned with.
I like this from Warren Sharp at Sharp Football on Twitter. Pointed out that the Seahawks, 83% of their passes this season have come from 11 personnel. That's three wide receivers, one running back, one tight end. And then split those out with or without play action. With play action, they have been successful 64% of the time, averaged 9.6 yards per pass attempt. Without play action, they have been successful 38% of the time for 5.5 yards per pass attempt. And the kicker, they have used play action on 12% of those passes.
I mean, I don't get it. Like, if you need to be a team that wants to focus on the run, why then do you not even practice what you preach, where you're saying we need to run the ball to be able to run play action? Then in the one game that you actually run the ball well, run fucking play action.
I agree.
Like...
But also run play action, not just out of an I form with multiple tight ends so that it usually ends up with like a 4-yard pass to Nick Vanette. Like, Would be nice to get the ball down the field more often.
I mean,
it's not really a fair complaint. Play action has been good.
It is a complicated thing to feel about, where it's like, I like the idea of the Seahawks running a quick pass offense. And I think that they did suffer in the Bears game where they're trying to get the ball down the field because they have a combination of a terrible offensive line. The problem is you do the quick passes to set up the long passes. Honestly, you pass to set up the run.
Yes.
And you play action to set up the run. You play action to set up long passes. You play action to set up quick passes. At no point do you run to set up anything else. You run to set up losing.
Or winning by 3 points at Arizona.
Good. I think Arizona's sneaky good. But good teams run play action often. You know, bad teams don't run play action.
You know, it's a team that runs play action often that the Seahawks are facing that's going to be pretty good. Hey, it's the Rams. So this leads to a question that Bill Barnwell posed on Twitter after we talked about it on the phone. What would you trade for Sean McVay?
Because, okay.
I started the conversation. I started the bidding at 3 first-round picks.
The problem is with Sean McVay. I mean, obviously, yes. You still need to give him talent. And, like, the Rams this offseason did a pretty exceptional job of going out and finding an insane amount of talent, considering the place that they were in. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, they went out and got Robert Woods, Brandon Cooks, Ndamukong Suh, Marcus Peters, Aqib Talib.
Yep.
Like, they have provided Sean McVay with tons of weapons because they didn't trade 3 first-round picks for Sean McVay.
That is accurate.
So,
And because they had a bunch of leftover high draft picks from the Jeff Fisher era.
Well, can I give you a hot take? I would not trade 3 first-round picks for Sean McVay.
But would you trade 2 first-round picks in a second in alternating years?
You know what? I've rethought this, and I don't think you even need to do that because Sean McVay is important, but there are other coordinators out there who matter.
Yes.
There are other coaches who matter who you don't need to trade. You just don't hire Brian Schottenheimer.
Yep.
Like, they didn't need to. We talked about John DeFilippo. It's like,
weirdly, is not running play action very much in Minnesota.
Well, you know what Minnesota's record is? He still has a pretty good offense, though.
It's had its moments.
I wish we had Adam Thielen. There are coaches out there who you don't need to trade 3 first-round picks for. Sean McVay is not it. Sean McVay has been incredibly successful. Also, Sean McVay does have a lot of weapons. Like, Sean McVay is in probably the perfect situation for it, for doing what he does. But there are other people who can mimic what Sean McVay does. Matt Nagy is somebody who got hired as the Bears head coach this offseason. The Bears have a lot of talent, but also, like, Trubisky's maybe bad. Or at least was maybe
not
bad.
Last week.
And Matt Nagy is able to turn him into, like, they picked up Trey Burton and it revolutionized the offense. Like, that could be done with a Russell Wilson offense. That's what I'm saying, is don't trade 3 first-round picks for Sean McVay.
Create a new McVay.
Create a new McVay for free.
Yes.
That's it. And keep your first-round picks. Don't trade 3 first-round picks for anything.
That's probably a reasonable take. Not as fun, but it's a reasonable tech.
I mean, I'm just being honest. If Sean McVay came here and you gave up 3 first-round picks, eventually Sean McVay would be bad. Because when you give up 3 first-round picks...
But eventually Sean McVay would be good because he's going to coach for like 3 decades. That's the argument for trading 3 first-round picks.
How many coaches are on the same team for 3 decades? It's a pretty rare thing. Do you think that Sean... How many coaches ever have coached the same team for 3 decades?
I don't know. Zero? I don't know how long Paul Brown was with
Unless
the Browns.
He becomes the Steelers head coach... I'm not anticipating him being the coach for 3 decades. But Pete Carroll's been the coach of the Seahawks for how many years? 9 years?
Yeah, but Pete Carroll
feels like a long fucking time.
It does feel like a long time. Pete Carroll's also a lot older than Sean McVay. I don't know if you've heard that.
Pete Carroll's been the Seahawks coach for 6 years over the last 2 years.
In further roster news, Michael Kendricks lost his appeal of his suspension after pleading guilty for insider trading, has now been suspended indefinitely, leaving the Seahawks without a starting weak side linebacker.
Shaquib's ready.
Is he?
He's ready. I think Austin, bring on the Rams.
I think the odds are better that Austin Calitro is ready.
Oh, my God. It's going to be so bad.
Maurice Alexander also tweeted that he's been re-signed. Given that the Seahawks signed a different safety, you would think that probably means that Maurice Alexander is going to go back to playing that linebacker role that he did for the Seahawks in the preseason.
Maurice Alexander was playing linebacker in the preseason?
Or at least the last preseason game he did. I don't know if he did before that.
It doesn't matter. Nothing matters.
Should we talk about the Seahawks running back rotation? So Chris Carson, sort of unexpectedly, a scratch from this game.
Maybe you do trade three first-round picks for Sean McVay.
Mike Davis comes in, and suddenly the Seahawks have a string of different players rushing for 100 yards. This week, we'll see if it's Rashad Penny or C.J. Procise.
Spoiler alert, it's not.
Yeah. It's a little disconcerting that the Seahawks have started two running backs this season and none of them have been the running back they drafted in the first round. You can't just sit there mournfully. That doesn't make for good podcasting material.
I mean, I don't know if it would be the hottest take to say that Mike Davis is the best running back on the Seahawks.
It would not be the hottest take. He's been the most effective this season.
I mean, Mike Davis looks good.
He's running hard.
But Chris Carson is not bad. I don't think Chris Carson is a bad running back.
The Arizona run defense is probably not good.
Yes.
And the return of DJ Fluker does seem to have helped the run game in general.
I guess so. Do you think the run game in general was good 2 weeks ago? They ran it a lot, but it was ineffective. Anyway, Mike Davis looks like the most effective runner on the Seahawks roster. I honestly think he should start this week against the Rams.
Yeah, I think he probably should.
I don't see why you like automatically turn back to Chris Carson.
It turns out that running backs might be easy to find.
No. No way.
Given that Chris Carson...
Why is C.J. Procise on this roster? They can't keep Ed Dixon on the roster from the NFI list, but C.J. Procise, who's like barely active, is still on the roster.
I guess he's contributing on special teams? I don't know. I haven't looked at the snap counts.
C.J. Procise is contributing on special teams? Just let C.J. Procise go if you're not going to use him.
That was part of the logic for why he made the roster, was his contributions on special teams. So I would say that was a factor in it. I don't know if that's actually happening during the regular season.
We've already talked about this. It doesn't even fucking matter. When you draft a running back highly, they need to contribute right away.
Procise played one special team snap on Sunday.
There we go. He's probably gassed from that one special team snap.
Oh, boy.
Couldn't come back in the game. Couldn't play in the second half because of it.
I think C.J. Procise might be done. I'm a big fan, but I just don't think he has the same burst that he had anymore. That's my take.
I probably agree with that take, but also part of the reason that we think that is because of his use in the Seahawks offense. And the Seahawks have proven...
But we've seen him run. He doesn't run fast anymore. That's an important thing for a running back. Yes.
Okay.
He's run.
Then let him go.
I guess.
LaVon Coleman would be a better running back than C.J. Procise at this point.
I don't think you would say that if LaVon Coleman hadn't been gone to UW.
I would say that if LaVon Coleman was a warm body. Any player who's on the roster, because you know what? Running backs don't matter. So if C.J. Procise is done, somebody else isn't done. Can he run forward? Then he's not done. Anyway, you need to get value. If you're going to spend a first-round pick on a running back, they had better be so good right away. I mean, they better...
Is Rashad Penny making more than both Mike Davis and Chris Carson combined?
I'm sure that he is. You're sure the seventh round pick, yes, and an undrafted free agent. Like, I mean, Mike Davis must be making the veteran minimum. But it's just they are illustrating this year. I hope that teams are taking note. I want the NFL to learn from this. They won't, but I want the NFL to learn
from this. I don't know if I do want the NFL to learn from it.
What, because we're going to take advantage of it? It doesn't matter. Like, what is the regime change that's going to happen? It's going to be 5 years. You know this isn't going to end after this year. Are you aware of this? I feel like I've become very nihilistic as a Seahawks fan.
Even more nihilistic than me, and I said hope is a bad thing and maybe the worst of things.
Just thinking of this, I was like, no matter how bad the Seahawks are this year, Pete Carroll and John Schneider are not getting fired. They could lose every single game for the rest of the
year.
I
think you're underestimating the chances that Pete Carroll just decides to go somewhere else.
I really don't think that's in Pete's makeup.
It isn't? Isn't that what happened at USC?
That he decided to go to like one of the best coaching positions out there where he's getting paid a hell of a lot of money. This is not, there's no opportunity available for Pete Carroll that is equivalent to what the Seahawks were to USC.
I suppose.
What would it be?
I think he saw the writing on the wall at USC. I mean, I agree that he wanted to take another crack at the NFL, but I also think he's pretty pragmatic, despite his intense optimism.
I don't know.
And Pete Carroll's like 85 years old. I don't think he wants to suffer through a rebuild if that's what the Seahawks need to do, because they just don't have very much talent.
He just doesn't see it that way.
But if they go 5-11, it becomes a lot easier to see it that way.
I really wish that we didn't have to hope. I hate that it ends this way. Look, the Mike Holmgren era ended this way, and that's kind of just the way it goes.
I mean, this is how eras end.
They're 2-2 and we're acting like they're already 5-11. It's like we don't even need to talk about the Rams. They're going to lose. They cannot stop this Rams offense.
Well, I did a lot of research. We're going to talk about the Rams.
All right, let's talk about the Rams.
So the Rams...
Wait, before then, do you think that Pete Carroll is able to coach as an underdog?
No. I don't think his entire philosophy or style is built towards it. It was perfected at USC, where they had more talent in virtually every game and were at worst on parity with the other best teams in the country when they played them in bowl games. And also, if you look at Pete Carroll's general optimism, I don't think he goes into most games thinking he's an underdog. So he's not someone who thinks about playing underdog strategies or, you know, basically, yeah, playing a more aggressive style rather than the more conservative style that he associates with victory.
Because a more conservative style typically works when you have more talent. I mean, honestly, USC had more talent at basically every position than every team they played.
You're really fond of that expression.
I mean, it's true, though, right? Like, when he was talking, he was like, oh, yeah, when we had linebackers, Brian Cushing and Clay Matthews, you're like, damn. Like, we talked about how
USC was pretty good.
Players, and physically, I don't think USC would have been able to compete with NFL teams. But if you took USC's roster in the peak, like 2004 or whatever, 2004 USC, and you took their roster.
In 2005 was the best team.
Aged it 4 years.
That was the team that lost to Texas.
When they were NFL 8 bodied players,
yes,
they would beat NFL teams.
Yes,
they would excellent NFL team.
Yeah. Quarterback play wouldn't be great.
But they probably, who did they have?
Matt Leiner.
Well, they had Matt Leiner as the starter. Did they have anybody deep?
Oh,
there?
In the backup. Matt Cassel, I believe, was a backup on that team.
Pete Carroll has always had such... I mean, you're talking about Brian Cushing and Clay Matthews, who were very high-level NFL linebackers. He's talking to them. It's like, dude, that's not who you have. Like, Bobby Wagner's very good, but...
I don't like this talk.
He does not have the tier that Clay Matthews and Brian Cushing were that much better than everybody else in the Pac-10 at the time. Is not what Bobby Wagner and Michael Kendricks and Austin Claytro are to everybody else in the NFL. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes. I mean, it's just not possible to have that in the NFL.
Yes.
I mean, Bobby Wagner, you can't get a lot better than Bobby Wagner.
And they probably had, I mean, you could look at that roster and probably find a lot of very good NFL players on it.
But you could probably also find some positions where they had guys that didn't go play in the NFL.
Starting?
I think so. All right.
Anyway.
I bet that's true. The Rams have naturally the number one offense in the NFL by DVOA. They are number one in passing, number four in rushing. And what's interesting this year is, so last year, Jared Goff, he rated pretty well by DVOA, but not very well by QBR because of the fact that a lot of his throws were relatively short, a lot of yards after catch. So he was 18th in QBR last year. This year he is up to number two. And we've seen him improve in terms of both his completion percentage up from 62% to 72% and his yards per completion up from 12.9 to 14.5 so far this year. It's not necessarily a ton more air yards, but just when you're that successful, you deserve a lot of credit for it. And I think we've heard less talk about Jared Goff as a system quarterback this year, and particularly after that Minnesota game when he was just terrific last week on Thursday Night Football. The Rams have great balance between their top three wide receivers, all three of whom have between 32 and 34 targets and between 24 and 26 catches this year. Brandon Cooks, one of the newcomers, has a team-high 17.4 yards per reception. Cooper Kupp with four and Robert Woods three have been more productive in terms of scoring touchdowns. Amazingly, the Rams, with Farrell Cooper injured, have not targeted another wide receiver yet this season with a pass, and just 10 targets for their tight end. So it's really those three guys and Todd Gurley who are threats in the passing game.
And Ray Maluga too. That was their linebacking core.
Okay, that's very good. I'm not disputing that. Todd Gurley was number two so far in success rate, successful on nearly 60% of his runs, according to Football Outsiders' definition. He's just 11th in DVOA. Hasn't necessarily been as God, explosive this season.
So good.
It's very good.
Okay.
Leads the NFL in both touches and combined touchdowns, having led the NFL in combined touchdowns and yards from scrimmage with 2,000 plus last season. The Rams line is number one in adjusted line yards and also has the lowest adjusted sack rate this season. So these are all good things. Defensively, I would say the Rams have not been quite as dominant perhaps as we expected. Our preseason assessment was we thought their offense would regress to the mean, but their defense would make up for it. That hasn't really been the case. They're only ninth in DVOA so far. Seventh against the pass, 23rd against the run. They've struggled versus tight ends, have been outstanding versus running backs coming out of the backfield and as pass catchers, averaging just 4.1 yards per pass attempt on throws to running back. They've had some issues to deep passes, particularly deep middle. You would say the safeties are probably the weakness of this team, especially after they added Aqib Talib and Marcus Peters at cornerback. Talib now on IR with a high ankle sprain suffered in week three.
IR with a high, that must be it.
Bad. Yeah, I mean, I think the expectation is he's probably going to be one of their two designations to return, although that'll be interesting because the Rams have a number of candidates for that. Dominic Easley, it appears, will be one of them after he underwent knee surgery, hasn't played yet this season. I think Farrell Cooper is also a candidate for that, although maybe less likely now. Peters played through the ankle sprain that he suffered in week three last week. The one surprise here, I think more than anything, is that the Rams haven't been very good in terms of adjusted sack rate. They're 26th in the league there. The one thing they gave up was Robert Quinn in that kind of edge pass rush when they got Dominican Sue to add him to Aaron Donald on the interior. Both of those guys have two sacks. Nobody else on the roster has more than one. But Aaron Donald has been known to wreak havoc against the Seahawks offensive line.
And it was definitely a factor against the Vikings.
Yeah, at the end of that game, he really stepped up. You know, they struggled defensively a lot of that game with Peters playing through injury, no Talib. But at the end of that game, Donald made the big plays that allowed the Rams to hold on for that victory in a really fun game. Surprisingly, the Seahawks so far have the edge in special teams this year over the Rams. That's largely because of the fact that Greg Zuerlein has missed the last three games after suffering a groin injury during warmups before week two. There's a chance he returns this week, but after replacement Sam Ficken went 1 of 3 on field goals the last 2 weeks, he was waived Tuesday and replaced by veteran Cairo Santos, who will get the call if Zuerlein is unable to return. Rams also hoping to get back their punt returner, JoJo Natson, who averaged 17.6 yards per punt return before having hand surgery, and it's a, quote, possibility, according to Sean McVay, he plays this week. So, I mean, I would say that, you know, the Seahawks defense may have some chance. Well, not without Earl Thomas.
Without Earl, though. I mean, yeah. You can't. Honestly, these stats don't matter.
Yeah. But the Seahawks offense versus the Rams defense is just such an unfair mismatch that... But they're better in special teams. Michael Dixon, as I tweeted about earlier, back up to number one in points added.
That's all that matters.
Yeah.
Like, this game is probably this Rams game against the number one offense in the NFL. Number one in passing, number four in rushing.
You're probably
going to be decided by punting.
You know, yeah, you really want is good punting and the ability to run the ball if you're probably going to be behind.
I really just don't see. I mean, when you were talking about the number one passing attack in the NFL, and you're taking Earl Thomas out of the equation.
It's not great.
I mean, how are the Seahawks going to stop them? They've had a bit of trouble generating pass rush. Like, it's there's they'll have no chance.
Yeah.
We saw at the end of last year what this looks like, and it's not pretty. It was the worst game of the Pete Carroll era. And it's probably going to happen again.
I don't know if it'll be quite as bad.
I mean, it would be maybe hard to be quite as bad. Let me ask you a question, though. Do you feel like Pete Carroll's brand of grind it out, maintain the ball, football, like long possessions, makes a little bit more sense against this high-octane Rams team?
I mean, it makes sense if you can actually score touchdowns on those possessions and what keep the like Rams off the field. What about
getting to the 50-yard line, fourth and two, and then you punt?
No, because then you're going to be behind, and then that stops working as soon as you're behind. Chances of victory?
I know that it's not zero. But I'm going to say 10%.
This is preposterously low. I'm at like 30%.
Are you kidding me? If they play this game 10 times, you really think the Seahawks win three of them?
They are at home.
Great.
Things happen.
Cool.
I mean, they're only... I don't know if this has increased since the line first came out, but they're only 7-point favorites.
Okay, let me ask you a question here. Are they more likely to win or to lose by 21-plus points?
Probably to win.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Cockeyed optimist.
We're to this point. We are to this point.
I just don't know if I've seen anything. If they win, I'm going to be ecstatic, right? Even if they win ugly, I'll be ecstatic. And they somehow won in LA last year.
That is true.
It felt like a different Rams team.
They had not quite figured it out yet. Felt like a different Seahawks team, too.
Also, if Cooper Kupp would have caught a touchdown pass, the Rams would have won that game. I don't know if I see the avenue to victory. I don't know what it is. I mean, maybe they run the ball and maintain the clock and the Rams offense isn't on the field. Has Jared Goff had almost any turnovers this year?
Not many. But he hasn't really been in particularly hostile situations so far this year, I wouldn't say.
The Seahawks are not winning this game.
It's the lowest 30% probability I can imagine.
I'm not going to see any of it. It doesn't matter. I'm going to be in Minneapolis for a wedding. I'm going to see no football this weekend. I'll be muttering on my phone, probably. If they do win, I'm going to figure out. If they're close in the second half, I'll figure out a way to watch it. If not, when that doesn't happen, then I won't.
Okay.
Just get to Oakland in week 6 in London. Try to be 3-3 going into the bye week.
I mean, they have played 3 of their first 4 at home. Their only road game so far at Oakland on Monday night. A game that they kind of struggled with in the early going, right?
So you think the Rams are overrated?
I think their chances of going undefeated are overrated. They did trail that game at halftime, 13-10 to the Raiders.
There we go.
They then outscored them 20-0, and they're 23-0 in the second half.
I mean, I think the Rams actually probably are slightly overrated. And I think that they've played probably pretty bad teams so far this year, and they've played them all at home.
Yes.
So.
But they're still the best team.
In the NFL?
Yeah. You think the Chiefs?
I think the Chiefs are better.
I think the Rams defense is... The difference between those two teams defensively has to be bigger than the difference between them offensively.
I mean, that's a pretty bad adjusted sack rate for playing like those games against those teams all at home.
It's not ideal.
If the Seahawks played the exact same schedule, what would their record be? As the Rams have played. Who have they played? They went at Oakland. Is that right?
And then home for Arizona.
Okay.
Home for the Chargers. LA Chargers and the Vikings.
Yeah, the Seahawks might not be that good. They might have lost 2 of those. They may still be 2-2.
I mean, the Rams have a better offensive rating than the Chiefs so far, and the Chiefs rank 31st in defensive DVOA compared to the Rams 9th. So that's cute about their adjusted sack rate.
If I have any glimmer of hope, it's that the Vikings, coming off getting destroyed by Buffalo, they could have won that game.
Yeah, it's interesting that it seems to increase people's confidence. I'm not sure that specifically was a great performance by the Rams, but they're still great.
Well, we'll see what happens. 10%.
On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.